His left arm was bloody. Shrapnel had pierced it in several places. His boots were on fire. A drum of 50-cal ammo had been hit, and he heard people screaming for him to kick it out, which he did, then stooped to pat out the flames on his feet. Two of the three men blown out the back were severely injured. One, Delta Master Sergeant Tim Grizz Martin, had absorbed the brunt of the blast. The grenade had poked a football-sized hole right through the skin of the Humvee, blew on through the sandbags, through Martin, and penetrated the ammo can. It had blown off the lower half of Martin's body. The explosion also tore off the back end of one of Private Adalberto Rodriguez's thighs. Rodriguez had tumbled about 10 yards before coming to rest. His legs were a mass of blood and gore. He began struggling to his feet, only to see one of the 5-ton trucks bearing straight for him. Its driver, Private Maddox, momentarily disoriented by another grenade blast, rolled the truck right over him. The convoy stopped, and soldiers scrambled to pick up the wounded. Medics did what they could for Rodriguez and Martin, who both looked mortally wounded. The wounded were lifted back into the vehicles, while rangers spilled out to cover the surrounding streets and alleys. At one, Specialist Aaron Hand and Sergeant Casey Joyce became engaged in a furious firefight. They were positioned at opposite sides of an alley. From just outside his truck, Spaulding watched rounds shatter the wall over Hand's head. Hand was shooting down the alley, too preoccupied to notice that shots were now coming at him from a different angle. Spaulding screamed for Hand to get back to the vehicles, but there was too much noise for him to be heard. From where Spaulding stood, it looked like Hand was going to be shot for sure. He was doing everything wrong. He was fighting bravely, but he had not sought cover, and he was changing magazines with his back exposed. Spaulding knew he should go help cover him and pull him back, but that meant crossing the alley where all the lead was flying. He hesitated. Hell no, I'm not going to cross that alley. As he debated with himself, SEAL John Gay ran out to help. Gay was still limping from where his knife had deflected an AK-47 round at his hip. He put several rounds up the alley and herded Hand back to the convoy. Across the alley, Joyce was on one knee facing north, doing things right. He had found cover and was returning disciplined fire, just the way he'd been taught, when a gun barrel poked from a window above and behind him and let off a quick burst. Carlson saw it happen. There wasn't even time to shout a warning, even if Joyce had been able to hear him. There was just a blap and a spurt of fire from the barrel, and the sergeant went straight down in the dirt on his face. One of the 50 cals promptly blasted gaping holes in the wall around the window where the gun had appeared, and Sergeant Jim Telcher, ignoring the heavy fire, sprinted out to Joyce, grabbed him by the shirt and vest, and without even slowing down, dragged him back to the column. Joyce's skin was already gray, and his eyes were open wide and rolled back, so you could only see the whites. He'd been hit in the upper back, where the Rangers' new Kevlar flak vests had no protective plate. The round had pierced his heart and passed through his torso, exiting and lodging in the vest's frontispiece, which did have an armored plate. They loaded him in on the back of Gay's Humvee, where a Delta medic went to work on him frantically, holding an IV bag up high with one hand, despairing. "We've got to get him back in a hurry. We've got to get him back in a hurry, or he's going to die." The convoy lurched forward again, turning left, bearing east, and then left again, so they were now heading back toward the north. They were moving up a road one block west of the crash site. To get there, all they had to do was drive two blocks north and turn right. But the gunfire was relentless. Up in the lead Humvee, Lieutenant Colonel McKnight was hit. Shrapnel cut into his right arm and the left side of his neck. At the rear of the convoy, Sergeant Lorenzo Ruiz, the tough little boxer from El Paso, who had taken over Private Clay Offick's 50-caliber machine gun after Offick had been hit in the arm, slumped and slid down limp into the laps of the men inside the Humvee. "He got shot! He got shot!" shouted the driver, who raced the Humvee frantically up the column with the 50 cal just spinning in the empty turret. "Get the 50 up!" screamed one of the sergeants. "Get the 50 up, ASAP!" Packed in the way they were, with Ruiz now slumped in on top of them, no one could climb into the turret from inside. So Specialist Dave Ritchie got out and jumped up on the turret from outside. He couldn't lower himself into it because Ruiz's limp body was blocking it. So he leaned in from the outside as they began moving again, swiveling and shooting the big gun, hanging on to avoid being thrown to the street. Inside, they pulled Ruiz down to let Ritchie get behind the gun. Staff Sergeant John Burns tore off the wounded man's vest and shirt. "I'm hit! I'm hit!" Ruiz gasped, and then began to cough up blood. Burns found an entrance wound under Ruiz's right arm, but couldn't locate an exit wound. They propped him against a radio, and a Delta medic went to work. Ruiz was in shock. Like many of the men in the vehicles, he had taken the ceramic plate out of his flak vest. Up in a Humvee turret behind a Mark 19, a machine gun-like grenade launcher, Corporal Jim Cavaco was pumping one 40-millimeter round after another into the windows of a building from which they were taking fire. Cavaco was dropping grenades neatly into the second-story windows, one after another. Bang, 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 bang. From his seat in the second truck, Spaulding shouted, "Yeah, get him, Vaco!" and then saw his friend slump forward. Cavaco had been hit by a round in the back of his head and killed instantly. The convoy stopped again, and Spaulding leapt out to help pull Cavaco out of the turret. They carried him to the back of Spaulding's truck and swung his body in. It landed on the legs of an injured ranger who shrieked with pain. The volume of fire was terrifying, yet Somalis seemed to be darting across streets everywhere. Up in the lead Humvee, Schilling watched the runners with bewilderment. Why would anybody be running around on the streets with all this lead flying? He found that by rolling grenades down the alley, it kept the shooters from sticking their weapons out. He tried to conserve ammo by shooting only at the Somalis who were closest. When he ran out of ammo, a wounded ranger in back fed Schilling magazines from his own pouches. Chapter 18. Over the radio came a hopeful inquiry from the command helicopter, which didn't seem to understand how desperate the convoy's plight had become.
"Uniform 6-4, you got everybody out of the crash site? Over?" "We have no positive contact with them yet," McKnight answered. "We took a lot of rounds as we were clearing out of the area. Quite a few wounded, including me. Over." "Roger. Want you to try to go to the first crash site and consolidate on that. Once we get everybody out of there, we'll go to the second crash site and try to do an exfil. Over."
This was, of course, out of the question. But McKnight wasn't giving up.
"Roger, understand. Can you give me some... We just need a direction and distance from where I'm at. Over."
There was no answer at first. The radio net was filled with calls related to Durant's crash. When he did hear from his commanders again, McKnight was asked to report the number of Rangers he had picked up from Eversman's Chalk 4. He ignored that request.
"Romeo 6-4.
"Harrell.
This is Uniform 6-4. From the crash site, where am I now? How far over?"
"Stand by. Have good visual on you now. Danny, are you still on that main hardball?"
"Paved road."
"I'm on the exfil road, down toward National."
Harrell apparently misunderstood. He gave McKnight directions as if he were still on Holwadig Road, out in front of the target house.
"Turn east. Go about 3 blocks east and 2 blocks north. They're popping smoke.
Over.
Understand. From my location, I have to go east further about 3 blocks and then head north. Over.
Roger. That's from the hardball road the Olympic Hotel is on. Over.
But McKnight was already 3 blocks east of that road.
I'm at the hardball road east of the Olympic Hotel. Do I just need to turn around on it and head north?
Negative. They are about 3 blocks east, 1 block north of Building 1, the target building. Over.
Chapter 19. In the convoy's second-to-last Humvee, where Ruiz was fighting for his life, Sergeant Burns couldn't get through to McKnight on the radio, so he took off on foot. He feared if they didn't get Ruiz back to base immediately, the young Texan was going to die. Burns noticed that the gunfire that had hurt his ears initially now sounded muffled, distant. His ears had adjusted to it. As he neared the front of the line, he saw Joyce stretched out bloody and pale, with a medic working over him furiously on the back of a crowded Humvee. He was about to reach the front when a D-boy grabbed him.
"You've been hit," the Delta operator said.
"No, I haven't."
Burns hadn't felt a thing. The D-boy slid his hand inside Burns' vest at his right shoulder, and the sergeant felt a vicious stab of pain.
"Having trouble breathing?" the D-boy asked.
"No." "Any tightness in your chest?"
"I feel all right," Burns said. "I didn't even know I was hit."
"You keep an eye on it," the D-boy said.
Burns made it up to McKnight, who was also bloody and busy on the radio. So Burns told Sergeant Bob Gallagher about Ruiz. Burns thought they should allow a Humvee or two to speed right back to the base with Ruiz, as they had done earlier with Blackburn. But Gallagher knew the convoy could not afford to lose any more vehicles and firepower now. They still had roughly 100 men waiting for them around the first crash site. Then there was the second crash site. Gallagher was already kicking himself for sending those 3 vehicles back with Blackburn. While he knew this might be a death sentence for Ruiz, he told Burns there was no way anybody was leaving.
"We have to move to the crash site and consolidate forces," he said.
Disgusted, Burns began to make his way back down the column to his vehicle. He had only gone a few steps when the convoy started rolling again. He jumped on the back of a Humvee. It was already jammed. The rear of the vehicle was slick and sticky with blood. Moaning rose from the pile of Rangers. Beside him, Joyce looked dead, even though a medic was still working on him. Sergeant Galantine was screaming,
"My thumb's shot off! My thumb's shot off!"
Burns did not want to be on that Humvee.
They were still pointed north. Some of the men were at the breaking point. In the same Humvee with Burns, Private Jason Moore saw some of his Ranger buddies just burying their heads behind the sandbags. Some of the unit's most boisterous chest beaters were among them. A burly kid from Princeton, New Jersey, Moore had a dip of snuff stuffed under his lower lip and brown spittle on his unshaved chin. He was sweating and terrified. One RPG had passed over the vehicle and exploded with an ear-smarting crack against a wall alongside. Bullets were snapping around him. He fought the urge to lie down. "Either way, I'm going to get shot." Moore figured if he stayed up and kept on shooting, at least he'd get shot trying to save himself and the guys. It was a defining moment for him, a point of clarity in the midst of chaos. He would go down fighting. He would not consider lying down again. Not long after he saw Joyce's shot, which really shook him up, Private Carlson felt a sudden blow and sharp pain in his right knee. It felt like someone had taken a knife and held it to his knee and then driven it in with a sledgehammer. He glanced down to see blood rapidly staining his pants. He said a prayer and kept shooting. He had been wildly scared for longer than he had ever felt that way in his life, and now he thought he might literally die of fright. His heart banged in his chest, and he found it hard to breathe.
His head was filled with the sounds of shooting and explosions and visions of his friends, one by one, going down, and blood splashed everywhere, oily and sticky with its dank, coppery smell, and he figured, "This is it for me." And then, in that moment of maximum terror, he felt it all abruptly, inexplicably, fall away. One second, he was paralyzed with fear and pain, and the next, he had stopped caring about himself. He would think about this a lot later, and the best he could explain it was, his own life no longer mattered. All that did matter were his buddies, his brothers, that they not get hurt, that they not get killed. These men around him, some of whom he had only known for months, were more important to him than life itself. It was like when Telscher ran out on the road to pull Joyce back in. Carlson understood that now. And it was heroic, but it also wasn't heroic. At a certain level, he knew Telscher had made no choice, just as he was not choosing to be unafraid. It had just happened to him, like he had passed through some barrier. He had to keep fighting, because the other guys needed him. In the second of the three Humvees behind the trucks, Private Ed Coleman sat behind the wheel, amazed and alarmed by what he was seeing. He saw a line of trees on the sidewalk up ahead begin to explode, one after the other, as if someone had placed charges in each and was detonating them at about 5-second intervals. Either that, or somebody with a big gun was systematically taking out the trees, each about 2 stories high, thinking that they might be hiding snipers. He found it strange, anyway, the blasts walking their way toward him, splintering the trees one by one. Coleman, who had felt such a rush of excitement an hour earlier as he encountered battle for the first time, now felt nothing but nauseating dread. So far, neither he nor anyone in his vehicle had been hit, but it seemed like just a matter of time. He watched with horror as the convoy disintegrated before him. He was a soldier for the most powerful nation on earth. If they were having this much trouble, shouldn't somebody have stepped in? Where was a stronger show of force? Somehow it didn't seem right that they could be reduced to this, battling on these narrow dirt streets, bleeding, dying. This wasn't supposed to happen. He saw men he knew and liked and respected bellowing in pain on the street, with gunshot wounds that exposed great crimson flaps of glistening muscle. Men wandering in the smoke, bleeding, dazed, and seemingly unconscious, their clothing torn off. American soldiers. Those who were not injured were covered with the blood of others. Coleman was young and new to the unit. If these more veteran soldiers were all getting hit, sooner or later he was going to get hit. Oddly, the surprise he felt overshadowed the fear. He kept telling himself, "This is not supposed to happen." And Coleman's turn did come. As he slowed down before another intersection, he looked out the open window to his left and saw a smoke trail coming straight at him. It all happened in a second. He knew it was an RPG, and he knew it was going to hit him. Then it did. He awoke, lying on his right side on the front seat with his ears ringing. He opened his eyes and was looking directly at the radio mounted under the dash. He sat up and floored the accelerator. Up ahead, he saw the convoy making a left turn, and he raced to catch them. Later, when he had a chance to inspect his Humvee, he saw that the RPG had hit his door, deeply denting it and poking a hole through the steel. He and the others inside had evidently been spared by the bulletproof glass panel behind the door. Coleman had the window rolled down. The brunt of the grenade's force had been absorbed by the Humvee's outer shell, and the glass barrier had been thick enough to stop it. Coleman's left arm began to swell and discolor, but otherwise he was fine. Dan Schilling felt better whenever they were moving, but the convoy seemed to inch along, stopping, starting, stopping, starting. Whenever they stopped, the volume of fire would surge, so many rounds that at times it looked like the stone walls on both sides of the alley were being sandblasted. There were plenty of targets to shoot at.
Up in the turret, Pringle unloosed the 50 cal on a group of armed Somalis. Schilling watched as one of them, a tall, skinny man wearing a bright yellow shirt and carrying an AK-47, came apart as the big rounds tore through him. Deep red blotches appeared on the yellow shirt. First, an arm came off. Then the man's head and chest exploded. The rest of the Somalis scattered, moving around the next corner, where Schilling knew they'd again be waiting for them to cross. As the Humvee came abreast of the alley, Schilling didn't bother to use his sights. The men were that close. The first man he shot was just 10 yards away. He was crouched down and had a painful grimace on his face. Maybe Pringle had hit him earlier. Schilling put 2 rounds in his chest. He shot the man next to him twice in the chest, and as he did, he felt a slam and a dull pain in his right foot. When they were through the intersection, Schilling inspected his boot. The door had taken 2 bullets. One had passed through the outer steel and been stopped by the bulletproof glass window inside it. The second had hit lower and had passed right through the door. The door, which was guaranteed to stop the AK-47's 7.62-millimeter round, had not stopped either bullet. The glass got the first, and the second had been slowed enough so that it hit with enough force to hurt, but not enough to penetrate the boot. Pringle had just put doors on the vehicle earlier that day. They'd done the previous 6 missions without them, and these had just arrived in a shipment from the States. Schilling had mixed feelings about them. He liked the protection, but the doors made it a lot harder to move. When he had checked them out that morning, he couldn't get his window to roll down, so he'd started to remove the door. Pringle stopped him. "Hey, I just put those on," he shouted. Schilling had showed him how the window stuck, and Pringle had fetched a hammer and simply whacked the frame until the window dropped down. Now Schilling was glad they'd kept the door, but some of the sense of invulnerability he'd felt was gone. Both bullets had gone completely through. They continued north for about 9 blocks, all the way up to Armed Forces Road, one of the main paved roads in Mogadishu. They'd gone past the crash site, only a block west of it, without stopping. The helicopters had directed them to turn right, but the alleyways looked too narrow to Schilling and the others in the lead Humvee. If the trucks got stuck, they'd probably all be killed. So they continued on. Some of the men in the convoy saw the downed Black Hawk just a block over as they went past, but no one had told them that it was their objective. Many of the men in the vehicles still thought they were heading back to base. As they approached Armed Forces Street, they stopped again. Schilling fought back feelings of futility. McKnight seemed dazed and overwhelmed. He was bleeding from the arm and the neck, and not his usual decisive self. Schilling muttered to himself, "We're going to keep driving around until we're all fucking dead." He then decided to do something himself, since McKnight seemed stymied. Using a frequency he knew helicopter pilots used to talk among themselves, he bypassed the C-2 Blackhawk and contacted the observation helicopters flying orbits higher up. Coordinating communications between the air and ground was Schilling's specialty. He asked them to vector him to the crash site. The choppers were eager to oblige. They told him to steer the convoy west on Armed Forces Road and then hang another left. McKnight gave permission for Schilling to direct them, and the convoy was moving once again. They made the left turn off Armed Forces and drove through the storm of gunfire for about 7 blocks before Schilling saw up ahead the smoldering remains of the 5-ton they had torched in front of the target building. They'd come full circle. Schilling hadn't told the observation bird pilots which crash site he wanted. The pilots could see how desperate things were around Durant's crash, where Somali mobs had begun to encircle the unprotected downed Black Hawk, and had taken it upon themselves to direct the convoy there. Schilling hadn't realized it until he saw the target house and the Olympic Hotel again. "We're headed for the second crash site," he told McKnight. The lieutenant colonel knew only what his orders were. He reiterated that they were to proceed to the first crash site.
On the command net, their wanderings had turned to black comedy. Matters were now complicated by the fact that a second vehicle convoy had been dispatched from the base to attempt a rescue at Durant's crash site.
"Danny, I think you've gone too far west trying to look at the second crash. You seem to have gone about 4 blocks west and 5 blocks south. Over."
"Romeo 6-4, Harrell. This is Uniform 6-4, McKnight. Give me a right turn. Right turn. Right turn."
"Uniform 6-4, this is Romeo 6-4. You need to go about 4 blocks south, turn east. There is green smoke marking the site south. Keep coming south."
A voice came over the busy command frequency pleading for order.
"Stop giving directions. I think you're talking to the wrong convoy."
"This is Uniform 6-4. You've got me back in front of the Olympic Hotel."
"Uniform 6-4, this is Romeo 6-4. You need to turn east."
So the convoy now made a U-turn. They had just driven through a vicious ambush in front of the target house and were now turning around to drive right back through it. Men in the vehicles behind could not understand. It was insane. They seemed to be trying to get killed.
Things had deteriorated so badly that up in the C-2 bird, Harrell was considering just releasing the prisoners, their prize, the supposed point of this mission and of all this carnage. He instructed the Delta units on foot, now closing in on the first crash site.
"As soon as we get you linked up with the uniform element, throw all the precious cargo. We're going to try and get forced down to the second crash site."
The voices from various helicopters, now trying to steer poor McKnight, recorded the frustration of his fruitless twists and turns.
"Uniform 6-4, this is Romeo 6-4. Next right, next right, alleyway, alleyway. They just missed their turn. Take the next available right, Uniform.
Be advised, they're coming under heavy fire."
"Uniform 6-4, this is Romeo 6-4.
God damn it, stop. God damn it, stop.
Right turn, right turn. You're taking fire. Hurry up."
In this terrible confusion, the men on the convoy saw strange things. They passed an old woman carrying 2 plastic grocery bags, walking along calmly through the barrage. As the convoy approached, she set both bags down gently, stuck fingers in her ears, and kept on walking. Minutes later, heading in the opposite direction, they saw the same woman. She had the bags again. She set them down, stuck fingers in her ears, and walked away as she had before. At every intersection now, Somalis just lined up on both sides of the street and fired at every vehicle it came across. Since they had men on both sides of the street, any rounds that missed the vehicle as it flashed past would certainly have hit the men on the other side of the road. Sergeant Eversman, who had found some better cover for himself in the back end of his Humvee, watched with amazement. What a strategy! He felt these people must have no regard for even their own lives. They just did not care. The city was shredding them block by block. No place was safe. The air was alive with hurtling chunks of hot metal. They heard the awful slap of bullets into flesh, and heard the screams, and saw the insides of men's bodies spill out, and watched the gray, blank pallor rise in the faces of their friends, and the best of the men fought back despair. They were America's elite fighters, and they were going to die here, outnumbered by this determined rabble. Their future was setting with this sun on this day and in this place. Schilling felt disbelief, and now some guilt. He had steered the convoy the wrong way for at least part of this calamity. Stunned by the confusion, he struggled to convince himself this was all really happening. Over and over he muttered, "We're going to keep driving around until we're all fucking dead." Chapter 20. Specialist Spaulding was still behind the passenger door in the first truck with his rifle out the window, turned in the seat so he could line up his shots, when he was startled by a flash of light down by his legs. It looked like a laser beam shot through the door and up into his right leg. A bullet
had pierced the steel of the door and the window, which was rolled down, and had poked itself and fragments of glass and steel straight up his leg, from just above his knee, all the way up to his hip. He had been stabbed by a shaft of light that poked through the door. He squealed.
"What's wrong, you hit?" shouted Maddox.
"Yes." And then another laser poked through, this one into his left leg. Spaulding felt a jolt this time, but no pain. He reached down to grab his right thigh, and blood spurted out between his fingers. He was both distressed and amazed. The way the light had shot through, he still felt no pain. He didn't want to look at it. Then Maddox shouted, "I can't see! I can't see!" The driver's helmet was askew, and his glasses were knocked around sideways on his head. "Put your glasses on, you dumbass," Spaulding said. But Maddox had been hit in the back of the head. The round must have hit his helmet, which saved his life, but hit with such force that it had rendered him temporarily blind. The truck was rolling out of control, and Spaulding, with both legs shot, couldn't move over to grab the wheel. They couldn't stop in the field of fire, so there was nothing to do but shout directions to Maddox, who still had his hands on the wheel. "Turn left! Turn left! Now! Now! Speed up! Slow down!" The truck was weaving and banging into the sides of buildings. It ran over a Somali man on crutches.
"What was that?" asked Maddox. "Don't worry about it. We just ran over somebody."
And they laughed. They felt no pity and were beyond fear. They were both laughing as Maddox stopped the truck. One of the D-boys, Sergeant Mike Foreman, jumped from the back of the truck, ran up, and opened the driver's side door to a cabin now splattered with blood.
"Holy shit," he said.
Maddox slid over next to Spaulding, who was now preoccupied with his wounds. There was a perfectly round hole in his left knee, but there was no exit wound. The bullet had evidently fragmented on impact with the door and glass, and only the jacket had penetrated his knee. It had flattened on impact with his kneecap, and just slid around under the skin to the side of the joint. The remainder of the bullet had peppered his lower leg, which was bleeding. Spaulding propped both legs up on the dash and pressed a field dressing on one. He lay his rifle on the rim of the side window, changed the magazine, and as Foreman got the truck moving again, resumed firing. He was shooting at everything that moved. To make room for more wounded on the back of his Humvee, Wounded Private Clay Offick, who had been shot in the arm at the beginning of the fight, jumped out the back and ran to the second truck. One of the men riding there proffered a hand to help him climb aboard, but with his broken arm, Offick couldn't grab hold of anything. After several failed attempts, he ran around to the cab, and Specialist Aaron Hand stepped out to let him squeeze in between himself and the driver, Private Richard Kowaleski, a skinny, quiet kid from Texas, whom they all called Alphabet, because they didn't want to pronounce his name. Kowaleski was new to the unit and quiet. He had just met a girl he wanted to marry, and had been talking about leaving the regiment when his tour was up in a few months. His sergeant had been trying to convince him to stay. Minutes after Offick slid in next to him, Kowaleski was hit by a bullet in his shoulder, which knocked him back against the seat. He checked out the wound briefly and straightened back up behind the wheel.
"Alphabet, want me to drive?" asked Offick. "No, I'm okay."
Offick was struggling in the confined space to apply a pressure dressing to the driver's bleeding shoulder when the RPG hit. It rocketed in from the left, severing Kowaleski's left arm and entering his chest. There was an explosion, but most of the 2-foot-long missile embedded itself in Kowaleski, the fins sticking out his left side under his missing arm, the point sticking out the right side. He was unconscious, but still alive. Driverless, the truck crashed into the back end of the one before it, the one with the prisoners in back, and with Foreman, Maddox, and Spaulding in the cab. The impact threw Spaulding against the side door, and then his truck careened into a wall. Offick had been knocked cold. He awakened to Specialist Hand shaking him, yelling that he had to get out. "It's on fire!" Hand shouted.
The cab was black with smoke, and Othick could see the rocket fuse glowing from what looked like inside Alphabet. The grenade lodged in his chest had evidently exploded before entering his body, because despite the missile embedded in him, his torso was still intact. The blast stunned Hand and Othick. Hand jumped out his door. Othick reached over to grab Kovaleski and pull him out, but the driver's bloody clothes just lifted damply off his pierced torso. Othick stumbled out to the street and noticed his and Hand's helmets had been blown off. Hand's rifle was shattered. They moved numbly and even a little giddily. Death had buzzed past close enough to kill Kovaleski and knock off their helmets, but had left them virtually unscathed. Hand couldn't hear out of his left ear, but that was it. Both men found their helmets down the street. They had evidently blown right out the window. Hand also found the lower portion of Kovaleski's arm, just the left hand and a bit of wrist. He picked it up, ran back to the Humvee where the D-boys had placed Kovaleski, and put it in the mortally wounded man's pants pocket. Still dazed, Othick crawled into a Humvee. As they set off again, he began groping on the floor with his good left hand, collecting rounds that guys had ejected from their weapons when they jammed. Othick passed them back to those still shooting. Many of the vehicles were running out of ammo. They had expended thousands of rounds. 3 of the 24 Somali prisoners were dead, and one was wounded. The back ends of the remaining trucks and Humvees were slick with blood. There were chunks of viscera clinging to floors and inner walls. McKnight's lead Humvee had 2 flat tires, both on the right side. The vehicles were meant to run on flats, but at nowhere near normal speed. The second Humvee in line was almost totally disabled. It was dragging an axle and was being pushed by the 5-ton behind it, the one that had been hit by the grenade that killed Kovaleski. The Humvee, driven by the SEALs, the third in line, had 3 flat tires and was so pockmarked with bullet holes it looked like a sponge. SEAL Howard Waston, who had been shot in both legs, had them draped up over the dash and stretched out on the hood. Some of the Humvees were smoking. Carlson's had a gaping grenade hole in the side and 4 flat tires. When the RPG hit Kovaleski in the cab of the first truck, it forced everything behind it to a halt. In the noise and confusion, no one in McKnight's lead Humvee noticed, so they proceeded alone up to Armed Forces Road, rolling now at about 20 miles per hour. The observation helicopters called for a right turn. The convoy had driven past the crash site a second time, about 7 blocks back, this time 1 block to the east of it, looking in vain for a street wide enough to make a left turn. When they reached Armed Forces Road, Schilling was surprised to find it deserted. They turned right and had gone only about 40 yards, planning to turn right again and head back down toward the crash site, when Schilling saw out his right side window a Somali step out into an alley and level an RPG tube at them. "RPG! RPG!" he shouted. The Humvee's big turret gun was silent. Schilling turned to see why Pringle wasn't shooting, and saw the gunner down in back grabbing a fresh can of ammo. Pringle raised his hands to cover his head. "Go!" Schilling screamed at the driver, Private Joe Hiroski. But instead of shooting out of the intersection, Hiroski turned into it and bore straight down on the man with the RPG tube. This happened in seconds. The grenade launched. Schilling saw a puff of smoke and heard the distinctive pop and the big ball of the grenade coming right for them. He froze. He didn't even raise his weapon. The grenade shot straight past the Humvee at door level on his side. He felt it whoosh past. "Back up! Back up!" he shouted. Schilling got off a few rounds, and Pringle was back up working the 50 cal before they'd cleared the alley. When Schilling turned around, worried they'd ram the Humvee behind them, he discovered they were all alone. Hiroski backed out into Armed Forces Road, where they turned around and headed west. They spotted the rest of the column where they'd left it, still facing north, just shy of the main road. McKnight, who had been silent ever since the U-turn back by the Olympic Hotel, seemed to recover himself at this point. He got out of the Humvee and conferred with Sergeant Gallagher outside by the hood of the vehicle. Gallagher was furious about the confusion, but as he confronted McKnight, he was hit with a round that knocked him to the street. He fell right at Schilling's feet. Bright red blood pumped in spurts from his arm. Schilling had never seen such scarlet blood. It was obviously arterial. It shot out in powerful squirts. He pressed his fingers to it and fished for a field dressing in his medical pouch. He patched up Gallagher as best he could, shoving in Curlex, a highly absorbent gauze that is used to help stop bleeding, and bandaging it tightly. In their weeks in Somalia, the PJs had given all the men additional training with field dressings. They'd practiced with live goats, shooting the animals, and then having the men work on them, getting their hands in some real gore. The experience helped. Gallagher walked back to his own vehicle, but Schilling kept his weapon. He needed the ammo. They had been wandering now for about 45 minutes. McKnight was ready to pack it in. There were now far more dead and wounded in the convoy than there were at the first crash site. He called up to Harrell.
"Romeo 6-4, this is Uniform 6-4. We've got a lot of vehicles that will be almost impossible to move. Quite a few casualties. Getting to the crash site will be awful tough. Are pinned down."
Harrell was insistent.
"Uniform 6-4, this is Romeo 6-4. Danny, I really need to get you back to that crash site. I know you turned left on Armed Forces Road. What's your status?"
But McKnight and his men had had enough.
"This is Uniform 6-4. I have numerous casualties. Vehicles that are halfway running. Gotta get these casualties out of here, ASAP.
They weren't home yet. They began moving, and everyone heartened as word passed back that they were finally pointed back to the base. Maybe some of them would make it out alive after all. They found Via Lenin, a four-lane road with a median up the center that would lead them back down to the K-4 traffic circle and home. Spaulding began to lose feeling in his fingertips. For the first time in the ordeal, he felt panic. He thought he must be lapsing into shock. He saw a little Somali boy who looked no more than 5 years old with an AK-47, shooting it wildly from the hip, bright flashes from the muzzle of the gun. Somebody shot the boy, and his legs flew up into the air as though he had slipped on marbles, and he landed flat on his back. It happened like a slow-motion sequence in a movie or a dream. The D-boy driving, Foreman, was a hell of a shot. He had his weapon in one hand and the steering wheel in the other. Spaulding saw him gun down three Somalis without even slowing down. He was impressed. He felt his hands curling up like someone with cerebral palsy.
"Hey, man, let's get the hell back," he said. "I'm not doing too good."
"You're doing cool," said Foreman.
SEAL John Gay's Humvee was now in the lead. It was riddled with bullets and smoking and slowing down, running on three rims. There were 8 wounded Rangers and Joyce's body in back, with Wasden's bloody legs splayed out on the hood. He'd been shot once more in the left foot. Wasden was yelling, "Just get me out of here!" The Sammies had stretched 2 big underground gasoline tanks across the roadway with junk and furniture and other debris, and had set it all on fire. Afraid to stop the Humvee for fear it would not start back up, they crashed over and through the flaming debris, nearly flipping, but the wide, sturdy vehicle righted itself and kept on going. The rest of the column followed. It was 5:40 p.m. They had been battling through the streets now for more than an hour. Of the approximately 75 men in the convoy, soldiers and prisoners, nearly half had been hit by bullets or shrapnel. 8 were dead or near death. As they approached K-4 Circle, they braced themselves for another vicious ambush. Overrun. Chapter 1. Too many things were happening at the same time, all of them bad. Task Force Ranger was 2 hours into a mission that was supposed to have taken an hour.
for General Garrison and his staff in the airfield JOC, watching and listening on TV screens and radio, and to element commanders Harrell and Matthews in the C-2 Blackhawk, circling over the fight, there came the awful recognition that events had slipped out of control. Their force was now stretched beyond its limits. Durant's crash site was in imminent danger of being overrun. Most of the original assaulters, about 160 D-boys and Rangers, were now either cut to pieces on the limping ground convoy or strung out on foot between the target house and the first helicopter crash site. They belonged to the strongest military power on Earth, but until some additional force could be brought to bear, they were stranded, fighting for their lives on city streets surrounded by thousands of furious, well-armed Somalis. Forces from a full company of the 10th Mountain Division, another 150 men, had arrived at the task force's base and thrown itself into the effort to reach Durant's crash site. But they were running into the same problems as the other vehicles, trying to move through the deadly ambushes and roadblocks that had been erected all over the city. Two more 10th Mountain companies were en route, and the UN's Pakistani and Malaysian forces had agreed to add their tanks and armored personnel carriers to the fight. But the logistics of assembling this polyglot rescue convoy would be daunting and would take hours. In two more hours, it would be dark. The men fighting for their lives out in the city knew nothing of the bigger picture. They could not see beyond the increasingly desperate struggle on their corner, and each still fought with the expectation that rescue was just minutes away. Shortly before Durant's helicopter had been shot down, the one and only airborne rescue team had roped into the first crash site, the one just blocks away from the target building. They had flown in on Blackhawk Super 6-8. Air Force Technical Sergeant Tim Wilkinson had been seated between the two crew chiefs in the back of it when a white chalkboard was passed from man to man. Written on it in big black letters was 61 down. The bad news produced a big jolt of adrenaline. It meant they were going in. They had been practicing together for months, a mix of soldiers from different units and branches. Wilkinson was one of the two Air Force PGs on board. With them was a five-man team of D-boys and seven Rangers. Ever since the mission had been drawn up earlier that summer, this team of 14 men had been preparing to rope down to a crashed helicopter, first at Fort Bragg and then in Mogadishu. Everyone knew there was a chance a helicopter could be shot down on one of these missions, although it was considered so unlikely that the CSAR element had originally been cut from the deployment. Garrison had put his foot down, and it had been reinstated. But the bird still had been considered something of a luxury and a nuisance, like the bulky boxes of emergency medical supplies and equipment Delta Surgeon Major Rob Marsh had insisted on hauling all over the world for the last 8 years. There was always a temptation to avoid taking such ominous precautions, like the way the D-boys went into battle with their blood types taped to their shoes. You didn't want to jinx yourself, but prudence dictated preparing for the worst. On the first six missions, the CSAR team had flown in circles for an hour or so and then returned. Wilkinson and the other Air Force guys practiced emergency medicine like an extreme sport. Their job was primarily rescuing downed pilots, and since there was no telling where or when a plane would crash, from mid-ocean to mountaintop, from frozen tundra to the middle of a crowded city, their unit's motto, "Anytime, Anywhere," was a point of pride. They were trained to climb cliffs, search deserts, and to dive out of airplanes at extremely high altitudes, if necessary, sometimes far behind enemy lines, to track lost and wounded flyers, patch them up, and bring them home. Their training was designed to push them beyond normal human constraints. Men sometimes died trying to pass the PJ course in the early 1980s when Wilkinson volunteered. He was 25 then, an avid outdoorsman. He decided to ditch a tamer career as an electrical engineer for something to make his heart pump faster. His personal nightmare had been the water drill at the Army Special Forces scuba training facility. It was called crossovers. Trainees were weighted down with water-filled tanks and dropped in a deep pool. Holding their breath, they had to walk 25 meters to the other end without coming up for air. For Wilkinson, it was hard enough just to go that distance without blacking out. But the instructors would deliberately detain him, push him backward, disorient him, pull off his mask and fins, rough him up, tangle him up with other trainees, simulating the helter-skelter, life-threatening stresses of a real-world rescue. To panic or black out meant failing the test. Those who made it across the pool had 30 seconds to catch their breath before setting out to recross the pool. This was done over and over again, until many of those who hadn't failed had decided to quit. And this was just one such sadistic exercise. Those who made it through tests like these, and who had years of experience performing difficult rescues, were gutsy, hardened risk-takers. But in the Special Forces world, the Blue Shirts were still considered slightly effete. The D-Boys called them shake-and-bake commandos, because the PJ route was considered a shortcut into the special ops community. In most other instances, the Air Force was the least physically demanding of the branches. Some of the D-Boys saw their presence and the four SEALs as a genuflection to intra-service rivalry. This was a joint operation. Everybody wanted a chance to play in this war. There were plenty of guys who rose above such pettiness, but there was enough of it in the hangar to color Wilkinson's weeks of deployment. It was something he and the other Air Force specialists had learned to live with. When the chalkboard came around, Wilson was immediately hungry for more information. Where had 6-1 gone down? Was it burning? How many people were on board? For him, apart from the physical danger, in this case being shot at, rescues were a mental challenge. People's lives depended on how well he could think on his feet. He carried two heavy bags, one for medical supplies, and the other containing tools for cutting open the helicopter and prying men loose. Training had taught him to cope with stress and how to handle the tools. The rest was all improvisation. Specialist Rob Phipps, the Phippster, was the youngest of the Rangers on board. He was 22. To the more experienced men, battle was a grim necessity, part of their jobs. They had weighed the risks, and for various reasons had accepted them. For Phipps, the prospect of going in was just thrilling. His pulse raced, and his senses seemed twice as alert. The only thing he could compare it to was a drug. He could hardly sit still. He had been a hellion of a teenager growing up in Detroit. Drinking and partying, breaking all the rules, running completely out of control. The Rangers had taken all that fearless exuberance and pointless bravado and channeled it. That was the secret core of all the hoo-ah discipline and esprit. You would be given permission, in battle, to break the biggest social taboo of all. You killed people. You were supposed to kill people. It wasn't often talked about in just that way, but there it was. Phipps didn't consider himself bloodthirsty, but he'd been groomed and primed for a moment just like this, and he was eager. He had his Car 15, which could fire upward of 600 rounds per minute, and he'd been trained to hit what he aimed at. Part of him never believed he'd actually be asked to do it. Now he reminded himself, this is for real. He was frightened, excited, and nervous all at once. He had never felt this way. As Pilot Dan Gelata called back, 1 minute, the men checked weapons, chambered rounds, and passed along whatever bits of information were offered by the crew chiefs and those at the doors who could see below. They moved over Walcott's downed Blackhawk exactly 8 minutes after it crashed. Gelata flew in from the north, flared, and then hovered about 30 feet over the street. The little bird that had gone in to rescue the two wounded D-boys had landed right on Marahan Road, but the Blackhawk was much too big to go all the way down. From his middle spot, Wilkinson couldn't see anything. He was taking his cues from Master Sergeant Scott Fales, his team leader. They made eye contact and nodded. This is it. Then Jalata said it was time. The ropes were kicked out, and men started sliding out. When it was his turn, Wilkinson noticed that the essential kit bags, which were supposed to be kicked out first, had been left behind. So he and Fales waited until the men before them had cleared the rope, and then kicked out the bags themselves. They made one last check around inside the now empty bird before they jumped. The delay was costly. As Jalata held his hover these few extra seconds, an RPG exploded on the left side of his airframe. It rocked the Black Hawk like a roundhouse punch. Jalata instinctively began to pull up and away.
"Coming out. I think we've been hit," Jalata radioed.
Confirmation was already coming from nearby little birds.
"You have been hit. Behind your engines. Be advised, you're smoking. We still have people on the ropes,"
one of his crew chiefs shouted. Jalata could hear his rotor blades whistling. Shrapnel from the blast had peppered them with holes. The aircraft sloshed from side to side. The blast had damaged the main rotor housing and had destroyed the engine cooling system. Instinct and training both dictated that he move out fast. But Jalata eased the Black Hawk back down to a hover for the remaining seconds Wilkinson and Fales needed to finish sliding down the ropes. Stretched out on the rope, Wilkinson heard the explosion above, but he was so intent on negotiating his descent through the brown dust cloud that he never felt the bird jerk forward and up, and didn't learn until much later how Jalata's cool had saved his life.
"You had better set it down pretty quick somewhere,"
came advice for Jalata from one of the helicopters above.
"You have a big hole on top."
"All systems are normal right now, just a little whine in the rotor system. I think I can make it back to the field," said Jalata.
"Be advised, you've got smoke coming out of the very top of the rotor. I suggest you go down to the new port. Put it down now."
"Let 8-6 make his call," said Matthews from the C-2 Black Hawk. "He looks all right."
Once Wilkinson and Fales were on the ground, Super 6-8 limped low and slow across the city, trailing a thin gray plume. Jalata struggled in the cockpit to fly it. It was like maneuvering a truck on a sheet of ice. The Black Hawk could survive without oil for a time, but losing the cooling system meant the gears would burn. He looked for an open field near the port.
"I've got the field in sight. All systems normal. I'm losing transmission pressure right now."
The sturdy Black Hawk kept going. They flew past the open field and then slipped over the fencing to the airport base. Jalata still faced the challenge of putting it down. He knew the chopper couldn't hold a hover, so he warned the crew chiefs in back to brace themselves for a hard landing. He radioed for emergency crews on the ground to be ready, and then just slammed the bird down with a quick roll at 60 knots. He put it right on the wheels. They hit with a jolt, but the Black Hawk stayed upright and intact. Chapter 2 Wilkinson heard the snap of rounds passing nearby as soon as he hit the street. It was hot, and in the cloud of dust he couldn't see. He ran to a wall on the right side of the street and waited for the dust to settle. He was carrying a small medical pack and his Car-15, sidearm, rounds, radio, canteen, and body armor. Instead of a K-pot, the standard U.S. Army Kevlar helmet, Wilkinson was wearing the lightweight plastic Pro-Tech hockey helmet preferred by most of the D-boys. Their specialized work called for them to move fast in and out of small places, so their primary concern was bumping their head, not taking a bullet or shrapnel. Wilkinson preferred the little helmet because he could glue a strip of Velcro to the top where he could fasten a flashlight. Wilkinson had one of the heavy ceramic plates in the front of his body armor, and with all the other gear must have weighed half again his 180 pounds, yet he didn't feel the extra weight. There had been some learned discussion in the CSAR bird about the pros and cons of wearing the armor plates. They were heavy, and in some cases were so oversized that the top of the breastplate jammed uncomfortably up under the chin of men seated in the choppers. Since so much of their time had been spent just sitting, there was ample sentiment in the bird for leaving the plates out altogether. The Kevlar itself could stop shrapnel at a 9mm round. Wilkinson figured the standard Somali weapon to be the AK-47, which fires a faster round, so he endured the plate in front, but not in back. It was a reminder of the all-important rule, never turn your back on the enemy. Except at this intersection of dirt roads and stone houses, the enemy seemed to be shooting from everywhere. He couldn't see anything. He took his heavy leather fast-roping gloves off and clipped them on his vest, waiting for the cloud to thin enough so he could see where he was.